All right, so last week we started formulating general relativity. That is a theory which takes into account gravitational fields. So it's like putting special relativity and now allowing for this to be true also in the presence of gravitational field. And then we basically could formulate the whole theory. We found the geodesic equation. We identified the correct fields for this, which is the metric field. But what we are really missing is the field equations for the gravitational field. And of course, these field equations are nothing else than the Einstein equations, which are written over here. And so last week, we could actually sort of, you know, argue what they have to look like. And so this was simply some tensor which depended on the metric and its first and second derivatives. And then I told you, you know, this tensor has to satisfy a special property that if you apply a derivative on this tensor, lambda mu on g mu nu, you have to get zero for any metric. And then I told you, well, this is basically a property which is sort of unique to one special tensor, and that special tensor is the Einstein tensor. Okay, so now to justify my statement, you have to go through this painful exercise of learning differential geometry and really learning what this tensor could be. And that will be our aim for next two lectures. And then hopefully by the end of the week, you will be able to write down these Einstein equations, but now basically knowing everything, why they have to look like, and they look like here. Okay, so we need to understand some differential geometry. We already understand the stage. The stage is, of course, the manifold. We now know everything about the manifolds. So then the next step is to put some actors on the stage. And the actors, of course, will be tensors. And so we also already understand basically the tensors. So let me just repeat the definition from last time. So a tensor of type K and L and rank where you sum the two numbers K and L is a multilinear map T, which simply likes to eat some vectors, and it likes to eat some forms, and it produces a number R here. So that's the definition of the tensor, and it has to be multilinear. So it's linear in each slot. So now how a typical tensor looks like is, for example, written here. So a tensor is a beast which has the components of that beast have basically k vector indices, alpha 1 to alpha k, and then L covector indices. And so this is how the components look like. And of course, this is the corresponding basis. It's just tensor product of the vector basis and of the covector basis. Okay. So now, of course, if you are interested how the tensor transforms, the tensor itself is an invariant object, so it doesn't depend on any coordinates. So T will remain invariant under coordinate transformations. These aren't just numbers, so who cares? But the basis does transform under coordinate transformations. And of course, we know how this thing transforms according to the chain rule. And we know how this guy transforms according to the differential, how a differential transforms. And that gave us, in the end, basically that the components do transform under change of coordinates. Okay, but we'll go there in a minute. So now these components here, what they really are, what these numbers here are, is basically I take this tensor and I eat the basis. So the basis, this is a basis, so this is a form or a covector, and this is a vector. So now the tensor with index alpha and beta, well, so it eats this basis here and produces a number. So now the statement, well, how do we see that this is indeed true? So what we have to evaluate is precisely this. Okay. So now this is my full expression for the tensor. It's T gamma delta and the corresponding basis. I'm just using two indices here. And then you want to eat dx alpha and d over dx beta. So how you do that is, of course, you know, what you mean by this writing here, this thing here, and comma this thing, is that means that you feed dx alpha into the first slot of the tensor. So you feed it here. And then this one, you feed it in the second slot of the tensor. Okay, so let's see what it does. So what it means is that I have to basically eat dx alpha with this thing here. The way how you do it is that, of course, you know that forms like to eat vectors. So feeding into the first slot corresponds to feeding dx alpha into the first slot of the tensor. And similarly, feeding this guy into the second slot means feeding this guy into the second slot here. So this is what it is. Okay, so now, of course, you use the definition of the dual frame. And the definition of the dual frame tells you that if I have dx alpha over d over dx gamma is just delta alpha gamma. So this will be delta alpha gamma. And similarly, this will be delta beta. Okay. So now I use these deltas, and they just change my coefficients gamma and delta to beta and alpha. And so this is, you just prove that this indeed is the component of the tensor. Okay, so that's how it works. So now you can do many operations with tensors. The tensors form an algebra. And so it's obvious that I can sum two tensors if they are of the same type. So if they have the same number of vector indices and the same number of covector indices, I can simply sum the two, and I get a new tensor which is of the same type. Okay, so another funny operation is that you can take a tensor product between the two tensors. So this creates bigger tensors. So, and basically how you do it is that you just write a tensor product between the two tensors. So let's have an example. So let's say I have a tensor T which is a rank 1, 1. So T is 1, 1 tensor. So it can be written as T alpha beta D over dx alpha dx beta. So that's one tensor. And let's have another tensor S, which is, let's say, a form. So S gamma delta dx gamma dx delta. Okay. So let's say we have two tensors. So this is 1, 1. What is this tensor? Of type, which type is this tensor here? S?
0, 2,
perfect. So this will be a 0, 2 tensor. So now you can take a tensor product of the two objects. So T times S. Well, and basically all you have to do is you just write a tensor product sign in between the two tensors. Okay, so what it is T alpha beta T over dx alpha dx beta times S gamma delta dx gamma dx delta. But you see, the components are nothing else than just the numbers. Okay, so then you can write this as T alpha beta. So what it means is that I can take them in front of the basis. So T alpha beta S gamma delta, and then D over dx alpha tensor product, dx beta tensor product, dx gamma tensor product, dx delta. So this is how you do a tensor product of the things. This is my new basis. And then what must be the case is that this guy here, of course, is just the components of the new tensor. So this is the components. So this is my new tensor, T dot S, and the corresponding components are alpha, beta, gamma, delta. And that's how you take a tensor product of two tensors. So you create from two tensors, which are of the rank 1, 1 and 0, 2, we just created a new bigger tensor, T times S. And do you know what the rank of this guy is? So the rank is 4, and the type is 1, 3. Okay, so this is a 1, 3. This is a 1, 3 tensor of rank 4. And this is how you do it. It's that simple. Okay, so that's an example of taking a tensor product of two tensors. And there's another operation which you can do with tensors, and that's a contraction. So basically what it means is that whenever I see a vector index and a covector index, I can contract them. Okay? So what it basically means is that, so let's take this tensor T, and so let's define a contracted tensor out of this. So what is T contracted? T contracted. Okay. So what you basically say is that, well, this T has one vector index alpha. Well, it has one slot which behaves like a vector and the other slot which behaves like a form. So now what it means is, if I want to take a contraction, is that the corresponding basis vector is the corresponding the other basis vector. So what is this? It's actually T alpha beta, and now that thing eats the corresponding basis d over dx alpha. Okay, so we just eat the basis. And of course, this is just delta beta alpha. So that means t alpha alpha. Okay, so out of a tensor which was run rank 1-1 tensor, we just created something which doesn't have any basis, so it's a scalar. Okay, so this is a scalar, so scalar. And so similarly, you could do the contractions between, you know, two tensors or whatever. And always how you do it is that you simply connect the corresponding basis of one form and the corresponding basis of a vector. You eat each other, that produces a delta, and it forms a contraction, effectively contraction in the indices of the two objects. Okay, so that's the contractions. And so let me just remind you finally that, you know, tensors are invariant objects. So whereas the components do transform, the tensors themselves do not transform. And so what it particularly means is that very special case, which is actually hopefully super useful, is that if tensor is zero in one frame, it will be zero in any other frame, in any other coordinate system, which may seem trivial to you, but it's, you know, basically 90% of all the calculations in general relativity, that you prove that the tensor somewhere vanishes, and then if it vanishes in one coordinate frame, and I know that it's a tensor, it will have to vanish, and you just prove the identity. So typically how you prove things, how you prove tensor equations, is that you choose some coordinate system where your tensors look nice, and then you calculate whatever needs to be calculated, and then you find something, and if, you know, and so you find that it's zero, for example, and if it's zero in this one frame, it will be zero in any other frame, and so you've just shown the identity. Okay, so that being said, although the tensors actually are invariant objects, the corresponding components, so the components of the tensors do transform. And the coordinate change, and they precisely transform as if you had the corresponding vector index or the corresponding one-form index. So if you have t prime, alpha, and then some indices, and mu, and some indices at x prime, it's simply d over dx prime alpha over dx delta, and then you have something, and then you have d over x kappa d x prime mu and something, and then t delta kappa. Okay, so this index transforms as a vector, this index transforms as a covector. And of course, it all comes from the fact that this basis transforms as we know it transforms. Okay, so that's what tensors are. Are there any questions? Okay, so we have stage, we have actors, but not quite. You know, what we would like to do is that we would like to play some, you know, interesting games with the actors. Namely, we would like to differentiate the actors. Okay, so the next step will be actually to introduce this covariant derivative, to introduce how to differentiate tensors. And of course, we need that because we want to write field equations. We want to write some differential equations for our tensors. And so we definitely need it. So part C is called connection. Connection. And so our aim is to differentiate tensors. And of course, you know, our field equations will be tensor equations. So once we differentiate a tensor, we better again get a tensor equation, so that the result better be a tensor as well. Be a tensor as well. because if it were not a tensor, we could find a frame where maybe it vanishes, but of course in the other frame it will not vanish, and such an equation is not really a nice equation. So we want to differentiate tensors so that the result is a new tensor. Okay, and so there are actually two problems with differentiating tensors, which you can immediately see when you try to differentiate a function of real numbers. So remind that for a function just in ordinary one variable calculus, df over dt at the point t0 is given by a limit s goes to 0, f of t0 plus s minus f of t0 divided by s. Okay, so this is how we differentiate functions. All right, so now this works beautifully for calculus of one variable, but if you differentiate tensors, suddenly a problem here. So there are two problems basically. So the first problem is, well, what you need to do is that you need to start with some argument t0, and then you have to enlarge that argument by adding some plus s to it. So what does it correspond to in the manifold is that I start at some point p of the manifold, and then I actually have to move my function, I have to look at my function at a point p plus delta p. Okay, so first question is, which direction do I go in the manifold? And even if I know where delta p is, well, where p and delta p is in the manifold, how do I go there? Do I go this way? Do I go that way? Do I go this way? Right, so there are two problems. So the first problem, two problems on a manifold, problems when on a manifold. So the first one is, what is t0 is something like p, but what is p plus delta p, which was originally s, right? So this is something like t0. And then I have to go plus s, but it means I have to go, you know, to some nearby point in the manifold. And, you know, what is it? And how do we go there? So if you have p here, and even if you know what you mean by p plus delta p, you know, do I go this way, or do I go that way, or do I go that way? Okay, and you know, in principle, the result may depend on how you go to p plus delta p. And of course, you know, first you have to define what you mean by p plus delta p. Okay, so that's first vague problem. And then the second vague problem is, well, for a function, this is fine. Well, function just eats the point. And so, you know, if you have function at p, you probably have function at p plus delta p, that's fine. If the function is defined everywhere on the manifold, no problem there. But what about a vector? So vector is an object which lives in its own vector space, right? So the vector space is a tangent space at a given point to the manifold, right? But what it means is that one vector lives, well, at the vector at p lives in a tangent space associated with the point p. But vector at p plus delta p lives in a different tangent space. So second problem is that, you know, a vector at p and a vector at p plus delta p live in different tangent spaces. In different tangent spaces. So if I have my manifold here, okay, so I have a point P, and then I have the associated TP of M. So now that's where my vector VP lives. But then if I move to P plus delta P, then there will be a different vector space. There will be TP plus delta P of M. Okay, and these are in general different vector spaces, And the question is, how do I compare a vector which lives in this vector space to a vector which lives in that vector space? And of course, that's non-trivial comparison, right? Because first I have to somehow say, well, how do I associate this vector space with that vector space? How do I move this vector space to that one? Okay, and so that's another problem. Okay, so how to compare the vectors which live in different spaces? Okay, so now resolution of these problems is what it is. So now you can define several types of derivatives based on how you resolve these two problems. So now the most common are three. So three common solutions. Three standard possibilities. So the simplest possibility how to differentiate tensors is called Lie derivative. Okay, that's the simplest one of them all. Lie derivative. Lie derivative basically. So in order to differentiate something, you will need to introduce an extra structure on the manifold, typically. So the extra structure which you introduce in case of the Lie derivative is the vector field. So you need vector field on the manifold. Once you have that vector field, it basically tells you, well, I can actually move along this vector field on the manifold. And then that tells me how I find from P my P plus delta P, because I am moving along the vector. Also, it tells you, well, I can actually drag the vector with myself. So if I can move a point from P to P plus delta P, I can also move a vector from V to V, from VP to VP plus delta P. So you can also drag vector. So now I drag my vector along the vector field, and I compare that vector with whatever used to be there, and that's my derivative. So this is the simplest possible, the most nicest, you know, the nicest and the most geometrical derivative you can ever have, and that's the Lie derivative. You will see that all the bloody details in the gravitational physics course. Okay, so the second one, which is also quite nice and simple, is that if you differentiate forms. So it's called exterior derivative. Exterior derivative. So that exterior derivative does not really need an extra structure, but works only for certain subset of tensors. Works only for a subset of tensors which are called differential forms. Differential forms. Okay. So that's super nice derivative as well. But it's not very useful for general relativity, at least not in this point. So again, you will learn about this exterior derivative in the gravitational physics course. So finally, the most complicated and super ugly derivative is the covariant derivative. Okay, so covariant derivative. And it's indeed true that whereas these two derivatives are super nice, this one is super ugly. Okay, super ugly. But the problem is that that's precisely what you need for general relativity. Okay, so that's the okay. It's always price to pay, right? So now, why is this super ugly? Is that, you know, for example, to make this work, in the case of Lie derivative, all I need is just vector field. Okay, so it's an object with one index. And vector, of course, is a vector field, so it transforms nicely under coordinate transformations. So here, the extra object, is a connection. It's connection. Let's call it gamma. And the connection has three different indices, alpha, beta, gamma. Alpha, beta, gamma. So suddenly, you know, instead of just having an object with one vector index, u alpha, you need an object which has actually three indices. But it's even worse than that. The connection is not a tensor. So the connection is actually a super ugly beast, which you actually have to prescribe how it transforms, so that nice, you know, so that this actually gives a nice derivative. So this is not a tensor, not a tensor. So you have an ugly object with three indices, which moreover, it's a new type of object on the manifold, and it does not transform as a tensor. Okay, so unfortunately, as I said, we need it for general relativity. So let's go ahead. Let's just do it in a pedestrian way. Let's just see how this guy has to look like and how does it have to transform so that we get tensors out of tensors when we differentiate. Okay, so are there any questions so far? So that's the painful way we have to go. So let's start. If you take a scalar function, so note that if you have a scalar, if phi is a scalar, and then you just take a partial derivative of the scalar, d mu phi. Okay, so I just differentiate phi with respect to d over dx mu. Then it's a simple exercise which I leave to you. This indeed behaves as 0, 1 tensor. Okay, so what you have to check is that d prime, so phi prime d over dx prime mu actually is related to d mu phi according to the transformation rule of a tensor. Okay, so this is fine. So now take a vector. Okay, however, if you take a vector and you take a partial derivative of a vector, so now you take d mu v nu, so you would like this to be a 1-1 tensor. Is that true? If I take a partial derivative with respect to mu and v nu, does it behave as a 1-1 tensor? So let's see, okay? So for that, we need to write d mu v nu. Okay, let's write d prime alpha so that I have the same thing. So I'm looking at the components d prime mu v prime alpha. Okay, and so what it is d over dx prime mu of my v prime alpha. But I know how the vector transforms dx alpha, dx nu, v nu. So this is how vector transforms. And then I just differentiate with respect to x prime mu. Okay, but now obviously I get two terms. I have to differentiate this guy, and then I have to differentiate that guy. And so the first term is this one, dx prime alpha, dx nu, dx beta, dx prime mu, v nu beta. Okay, so that's if I differentiate this thing here. But I also have to differentiate the first guy. And so it's just d square. Okay, let me write what is written here. Hopefully that's correct. Dx prime mu, d square, x prime alpha, dx beta, dx nu, and then v nu, okay? So the first term comes from differentiating this guy. The second term comes from differentiating the thing, but writing it in terms of, you know, new derivative, new coordinates, okay? So now if you look at this thing here, so if a partial derivative of a vector were a tensor, it would have to be 1-1 tensor. So it would precisely transform this way. So this part, this term here, is precisely how you would expect that a 1-1 tensor should transform. So this is okay. This is okay for 1-1 tensor. And so that's a good part. But of course, this is in addition to what you would expect. So this is a problem. All right. So indeed, you know, just partial derivative of a vector is not a 1-1 tensor because we have this extra term here, which we don't like. Okay. So now what do we do with this is that, well, we follow Riemann and his PhD thesis in 1830, and then we introduce the following derivative, which is an upgrade of this just partial derivative. So then Riemann proposes, Riemann in 1830, in his PhD thesis, he says, well, let's consider, instead of a partial derivative, let's consider a covariant derivative. So now we take a covariant derivative of a vector v nu. And let's just define this to be d mu v nu, which is the partial derivative one, which we just studied, but plus some correction, plus gamma mu alpha beta alpha mu v alpha. So that's the correction. And the correction is precisely such that gamma nu, is there a mistake? Nu alpha mu. No, I'm just making a mistake here. So we just made a correction to a partial derivative by including another term. And of course, we require that the result transforms as a 1-1 tensor. So in order nabla mu v nu be a 1-1 tensor, we require that this connection gamma has certain transformation properties. And what these transformation properties are is that they precisely have to cancel. You know, when you consider gamma prime, they exactly have to cancel this unwanted term here, which we don't want. Okay, so 1-1 tensor, and this requires that gamma prime alpha beta gamma actually almost transforms as a 3 tensor, but not really. So this would be the right term for a tensor, dx kappa, dx delta, dx prime beta, dx iota, dx prime gamma, kappa delta iota. So this would be if it did transform as a 3 tensor. But now I have to add, always subtract first. You have to basically kill that term. So that term has 2 derivatives of x prime alpha. So I'll have to have that term as well. So it's minus d square x prime alpha dx kappa dx delta and dx kappa dx prime beta dx delta dx prime gamma. So this is precisely the transformation property I have to impose so that the resulting object just transforms as the first term, but not the second one. Okay, and so any object which transforms in this way is called a connection. So this gives you a connection. Super ugly, isn't it? Okay, so I'm not going to prove now that indeed this will transform as a 1-1 tensor, but you will do it, you know, safely during your tutorial. So that really this is the right thing to do. Okay, so the statement is I have to introduce a new object on the manifold, And this object does not, it has three indices, it doesn't transform as a three tensor, but rather has this ugly term here. So this is an ugly term. Ugly term, which is precisely designed so that this ugly term cancels that problematic term over there. Okay, and that's what connection is. Everybody happy? It's worse than PhD thesis, isn't it? All right. So, more formally, you can actually, so this is super ugly, right? So now I know how to differentiate vectors. It's simply with the help of this connection here. So now we introduce the covariant derivative. And this has some nice properties, which you can actually use as a definition of the covariant derivative if you want to. So formally, So formally, we can write that a covariant derivative, covariant derivative nabla is a map which maps K and L tensors to K and L plus 1 tensors. Okay, so covariant derivative basically adds one more form index. Okay, so it's a map which maps KLn tensors to K and L plus 1 tensors, such that it satisfies some properties. So first, it is a derivative. This a derivative, meaning it is linear and it obeys the Leibniz rule. It's linear and obeys the Leibniz rule. Okay, so that doesn't specify nabla completely. So next, you need to know how nabla acts on scalar functions. Well, that was the observation which we started with, that the partial derivative will do fine if it acts on scalars. So on functions, so then we have nabla mu on a function. It's just a partial derivative of the function. And so this is fine. So on functions, we know how it acts. This is on functions. Okay. Third is that you need to know how it acts. Well, okay. So I already told you basically how it acts on a vector, but we better know how it acts on a covector as well. And so in order to find that, you need to know how it acts. So if I know how it acts on a vector, I better be able to tell how it acts on a covector as well. And so that's due to the contraction. Okay, so then it commutes with contraction. So if you have nabla, and then it acts on a tensor where two indices are contracted. Okay, it basically acts like if the indices were not here. So it acts like T nabla T contracted, which only has the indices but without the alpha. So basically, I would have to differentiate this index and that index, but the statement is that I don't have to do it. It just acts like it acts on the other indices. Okay, so that's how it acts on a contraction, and that's a useful property. And then finally, the property number four is that interesting thing to consider is a commutator of derivatives. Okay, so then if you have a commutator nabla mu, nabla nu, and this acts on a function, so what I mean by this is nabla mu, nabla nu, minus nabla nu, nabla mu. Okay, it's nabla mu, nabla nu, minus nabla nu, nabla mu, acting on a function. And then the statement is that this is equal to some tensor acting on this function. And so it's T kappa mu nu kappa kappa on F. Okay. So this is how it acts. If you have a commutator of two covariant derivatives when they act on a function, and so there is a new tensor T here, and that acts on this gradient of F. So this tensor here is called torsion. And if you just use this formula and use the prescription how it acts on whatever, then you find that the torsion actually is just a antisymmetric part of your connection. Okay, so T alpha beta gamma is just gamma alpha, now it's the other way, gamma beta minus gamma alpha beta gamma. Okay, so that's how the torsion tensor is defined. So you take any connection which satisfies this transformation property, and you just swap the two indices. So you have gamma beta minus beta gamma. So you basically antisymmetrize the connection in the lower two indices. And this is a new object. But now notice how this gamma actually transforms. So it transforms as a tree tensor apart from this ugly term. But if you actually swap the two indices, so if you antisymmetrize over gamma and beta, this term will precisely cancel. So then the resulting object will transform as a tree tensor. And this is indeed a tree tensor called torsion. Okay, this is a tensor. Okay, so now we know how to differentiate objects. So let me just show, well, maybe not. So you can use these properties 1 to 4 as a definition of what you mean by covariant derivative. So simply you introduce the connection, and you know, with the help of this connection, you have properties of the derivatives like that. But we already defined our covariant derivative, how it acts on vectors. So this is how it acts on vectors. You just take a partial derivative of a vector and add a gamma term here. So now, from these properties, it should follow how it acts on any other tensor. Okay, so in particular, on a covector. So it follows from here. It follows that if I want to differentiate a covector, I get the following nice formula. So now I have nabla alpha omega beta. So now I'm differentiating covector here. And it's again given by a partial derivative, d alpha omega beta, but now with a minus sign. Minus gamma gamma beta alpha omega gamma. Okay, so this is how a covector transforms. And well, of course, you can prove it from those properties here. Let me just show you without any indices the idea of the proof. So idea of proof of proof. And so the idea is to consider a contraction of a vector with a form. Okay, so now you consider what a covariant derivative of a vector times form is. So this is a contraction between a vector and omega, and so it's V alpha omega alpha, and then you want to take a covariant derivative. Okay, so this is a contraction. So due to the property number one, it has to satisfy the Leibniz rule. So by one, this better be equal to nabla b times omega plus b times nabla omega. Okay, but we very schematically know, but at the same time, because I'm doing a contraction here, I'm contracting b alpha with omega alpha, the result is a function. Okay, so then I know that my covariant derivative acts on a function, it has to reduce the partial derivative. So now, by property number two, this better be equal to just the partial derivative of b times omega. So let us check that with this definition it is. Okay, so is it? So using the formula now for a vector, it's dv plus gamma times v. So this is dv plus gamma v times omega. Okay, I'm just suppressing all the indices. You can put them in if you want to. And then the other term is plus v times. So nabla acting on omega, I'm trying to prove that that's with minus. Okay, so it's d of omega minus gamma acting on omega. Very good. So then I have dv. Oh. So then this is dv times omega. And then I have term gamma v omega. But then I have a term minus v gamma omega. So they actually cancel. And so plus v times d omega, which is nothing else than d of v times omega. So it actually agrees. So that's why there must be a minus sign here. All right, so this is a this is a proof. Of course, the proof works very well. So if you just put back all the indices, then you can make this very precise, right? So I'm just outlining the idea of the proof. But if you put back all the indices, this will work precisely.
Why do you need to put the indices?
Because you know. So what I said is that basically this term cancels that term. So in order to make sure that really this is the case, yeah, all the indices better match, right? So I really need to show that this term cancels that term. But they do. All right, and so now we understand how to differentiate tensors. So all we need is a connection, which is a beast, which transforms in this way. And then once we have that, we can differentiate vectors, we can differentiate forms. And then, of course, this basically generalizes to any tensors. And the differential of any tensor will simply pick up gamma terms for each index which you differentiate. So now, In general, it follows, and again, this is simple from those properties to show, is that if you differentiate nabla alpha, and then you have a tensor which has some indices down and some indices up, then it will be just a partial derivative, p beta, and then gamma, and plus gamma terms if you have vector index, and then minus gamma terms if you have a form index. So it will be plus gamma delta alpha d beta delta. So I just differentiated the vector index up, this one here. And then I have to differentiate this index here. But that's a form index, so that will be with a minus sign. So there's plus other terms which you have the vector indices, but now minus gamma rho beta alpha d rho and gamma. And then now I differentiate with a minus sign this index down, and then minus other terms if you have more indices down. So that's a general formula for a covariant derivative. And of course, you can derive this formula by saying, well, this tensor, it's basically like it behaves like a product of that many forms and that many vectors. I know how each of them transforms, and so I just write the formula, and then I have to put them back, and this is what you get. Okay, so these derivatives, it's actually a super simple work. So if you are to prove some identities about derivatives, for example, that covariant derivative can be written in terms of the Lie derivative plus some other corrections, all you have to do is that basically you have to check that the equality is true on a function, and then you use and let's say on a vector, and then provided it's valid for contraction, all the derivatives are, and provided that it's a derivative, meaning the Leibniz rule is true, then it will be true for any other object. So checking identities for derivatives is super simple, because every derivative will satisfy Leibniz rule and contraction thing and so on. So all you have to do is to check the identity for a function and for a vector, for example. And then it will be true in general for any other tense. All right, questions? That's the connection. So notice that we have not used the word metric anywhere so far. Okay. So the statement about covariant differentiation of tensors is completely independent of metric. Okay. And so we can always do it, provided we are given a connection on the manifold, which has this transformation properties. Okay. So now everything becomes much nicer if you do have a metric. So now part D is the metric. So now what it is? A metric is a symmetric non-degenerate zero to tensor and in general relativity we will have we will have pseudo-Riemannian geometry. So it will we will require is that actually the eigenvalues of the metric will be there will be 1 minus eigenvalue and then 3 plus eigenvalues. So we require is that it is of pseudo-Riemannian signature. That means 1 eigenvalue is negative, and then 3 eigenvalues are positive. Okay? And so that will be our metric in general relativity. So it's nothing else than just a rank, just a type 0 to tensor. And what we'll require in addition to that is that we have pseudo-Riemannian geometry. Meaning that actually this is not a positive definite tensor, but rather 1 eigenvalue is negative and 3 are positive. Okay, so then what it means is that of course we have an object G, that's our tensor, and this is how it has to look like. And this is the basis for the tensor, 0 to tensor. It is symmetric, so I can swap the two indices mu and nu. People often do not write the tensor product between dx mu and dx nu. So they would just write g mu nu dx mu dx nu. That's fine. Okay, just remember that the tensor product is in between the two things. And this is how you should be writing what a metric is. But now people write something horrifying. And people write that this is equal to ds square. Okay, which is the most horrifying thing ever. Okay, so why? So of course, when dealing with tensors, as we were dealing with tensors, this thing makes absolute sense. This thing, well, we just omitted the tensor sign. That's fine. We still remember the tensor sign is there, tensor product is there. But what the hell this means, right? So what it actually means is that metric, measures scalar product. It's like a scalar product. It measures, the product between two vectors. It measures a magnitude of a vector. So being a 0 to tensor, it means I can feed the metric two vectors. And it produces a number. Okay, so that's what the 0 to tensor means. So note note that a metric can eat two vectors. So these are vectors. And gives a number. Of course, what that number is nothing else than just g mu nu, v mu, w nu. Right? So what is this number is that we have g mu nu, v mu, w nu. Okay? Or it's just a scalar product between v and w. Okay, so that's what that number is. So it measures sort of scalar products between two vectors. So in particular, if I take w equal to v, then it measures the magnitude of the vector v. So specifically, if I take v equals to w, the other way around, w equal to v, then I have g vv is nothing else than v times v, or v square, which is the magnitude of the vector. Of course, because we are in pseudo-Riemannian signature, you know, this need not be positive and can be negative because of this minus one eigenvalue there. Okay? So it can be both positive or negative. If it were only positive, then we would have Riemannian signature. All the eigenvalues of this metric would be positive. All right, so we have this. But now what this thing here means. So people write ds square like a line element. So it's like a distance between two points. So what they think about now is that I have a point P, and I have a point P plus delta P, and they differ by some change dx mu. Okay. So now what actually this thing here means is that I have a distance between two space-time points, ds square, which is the metric evaluated on a vector which connects the point P and P plus delta P, and it measures the distance of that vector, the magnitude of that vector, dx, where these are understood now as vectors connecting two nearby points on the manifold. Two vectors connecting nearby points. Okay, and that's where, you know, this horrible notation comes from. So of course, this is g mu nu, and now my vector v mu, so dx nu. But of course, you know, in order to write this, you really need to understand what dx as a vector connecting nearby points is. And that's actually quite...
It is not like a connection, because it seems like... In the way you're saying it, it's like a connection because you're comparing like vectors from different spaces.
Connection. Yeah, this is something, you know, which requires some effort to define correctly. Yeah, so I super hate this, right? So it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So it doesn't make sense. So it's historically, right? So historically, people like to measure distances. And they think about, you know, I have two nearby points. They are connected by a vector. I calculate the magnitude of this vector using the metric, and this is what it is. Right? So this is really like a distance element of the two nearby points. But of course, on the manifold, this is problematic. Okay, so that's why I would actually end here. I would say that the metric is a two-tensor, which looks like this. Okay, but historically, in all the papers, you will see ds square is g mu nu dx mu dx nu. Okay, so just you have to live with that. This is just a history. Okay?
Can you say a little bit about how we can make
better not. So, better not to. So really, you have to say that this is a vector, right, which connects this point and that point, dx mu. Right? But of course, we know that dx mu is just a differential of x mu coordinates, so it should be better a form, not a vector. So this is completely confused, right?
Huh? It is not related to Schultz connection.
No. This is just measuring the distances, well, how the distances look like at a given point. Right? So I'm evaluating everything here at the point P. Right? So this is the history. This is the reality, the cold hard truth, what actually is true. Okay? Anyway, so that's the metric. So now I told you, if we have a metric, covariant differentiation becomes nicer. Okay, why? Because now there is a unique and nice connection determined by the metric. Okay, so now let's go to Christoffel symbols. Christoffel symbols, which are a special case of a connection. And so for this purpose, we already know what the torsion is. So the torsion is a tensor which is given by the antisymmetric part of the connection. At the same time, you can use this as a definition. It's something like, if I take a commutator of two derivatives on a function, it's proportional to the torsion. Okay? So now the statement is, if we have no torsion, so now theorem, so if the torsion is zero, so T alpha beta gamma equals to zero, if torsion vanishes, and another tensor, which we call M, so M alpha beta gamma, which is a derivative of the metric, so a covariant derivative acting on a metric, let's call it a new tensor, of course. Well, I'm differentiating a tensor, so the result has to be a tensor. It's called a metricity tensor, also vanishes. So this is called a metricity tensor. So if you require these two properties, so I require that the torsion is zero, namely that the antisymmetric part of connection is zero, and in addition, the metricity tensor vanishes, then actually your connection is uniquely specified, and it's given by the Christoffel symbols. So then we have unique connection. So there is only one such connection which has these two properties. Unique connection. This stopped working finally. There we go. And it's given by Christoffel symbols. And that's the formula we derived last week. Namely, that gamma alpha beta gamma is 1/2 g alpha mu g mu beta gamma plus g mu gamma beta minus g beta gamma mu. Okay, so that's how our connection has to look like. If both metricity is zero and the torsion is zero.
What is the fundamental theorem of Riemannian?
It's fundamental for us. That's definitely true. It could be some, yeah. Okay, so actually the proof of this is a little bit long, but it's not difficult. So all you have to do is that basically you know from here that the connection has to be symmetric in the lower two indices. So if the torsion is zero, gamma alpha beta gamma must be the same as gamma alpha gamma beta. You know that. And then you can write what it means is that the covariant derivative of the metric vanishes. So the covariant of the metric is given by partial derivative of the metric plus gamma gamma term, or minus gamma gamma term. Okay. And so then you just have to write it explicitly, and you have to do some tricks, and it's written in the notes. So if you are interested in the proof of this, just see, and it's, you know, couple of lines.
So is torsion between zero a condition that we make, or is it?
Aha. That's a very good question. So in general relativity, it's an assumption. Mm-hmm. So assumption of general relativity is that basically the metric is the only thing which contains any information about gravitational field. And so in particular, what it means is that we are setting torsion equal to zero. So it's an assumption of general relativity. You can go beyond general relativity, in which case you will have the torsion as well. And in fact, it's quite fun. So we shall see, well, of course, Einstein equations tell you, well, the metric is dynamical quantity. So provided the method distribution, I can find what the corresponding metric is, what the corresponding thing is. So similarly, you can make torsion dynamical. The source of the metric is basically energy momentum of the matter. So the source of the torsion is the spin of the matter. So if you have, I don't know, spinning systems, then you would have non-trivial torsion inside. Okay. Similarly, there are theories where the metricity tensor can be dynamical. I thought there are none, but I stand corrected from last year. There is a theory which actually has a dynamical metricity tensor. And so you have generalizations of general relativity, including all these things. So in GR, the only dynamical is G mu nu, the metric. But if you go beyond GR, you can have torsion beyond GR, both torsion and the metricity can be dynamical. And if they are dynamical, of course, that means that they are not equal to zero. They are something which are determined by the properties of the matter.
You just said something, it's not completely related to the question before, but you say something which is that gravity, this is something that I've always wondered. So gravity is, we only write equations for G, right?
Mm-hmm.
So gravity is contained in that G. But before, in this generalization from special relativity to general relativity, there was also another structure before we added the G, which was that we added this notion of topology. The topology could be non-trivial, right? So is gravity, so how do you measure the topology? Like how do you write down in an example, oh, the topology has to be this because there is the sun in the middle.
Well,
how do you have to do?
Okay, I don't know if I answered that question. Well, so certainly what is true is that in the field equations, in the Einstein equations, the topology of the manifold is basically fixed. So you have to basically assume what the topology is, and then you are just solving locally for the metric. That's not entirely true. The Einstein equations actually are not consistent with certain topologies. So you cannot actually, so there are restrictions on topology so that the Einstein equations are true. But yeah, in principle, if you consider quantum gravity or whatever, the topologies could be changing. I don't know. I don't know if that, yeah. All right, so we have a unique connection in general relativity. All we have is the metric, and the metric defines a unique connection, and it's the connection given by the Christoffel symbols, which we derived already last week. Okay, so now, of course, we know that the most crucial principle for general relativity is the equivalence principle. And so we formulated already a couple of versions. So one version is that A equals to small g for homogeneous fields. That's one version. The other version was that we can go to the Einstein's elevator. So now let's formulate a mathematical version of this equivalence principle, which is crucial for general relativity. So now there is a principle of equivalence theorem. Principle of equivalence and it says that at every space-time point I'm point P we can introduce inertial or freely falling frame, local inertial or freely falling frame, freely falling frame, so that basically we know that the laws are the same as in special relativity. So we know that the metric actually locally can be written as a flat metric. So g mu nu in this frame just looks like eta mu nu. But actually, it's better than that. You can also get rid of the Christoffel symbols. So also, g mu nu partial derivative rho is equal to 0 at p. And that's the precise mathematical statement of the equivalence principle. So the statement is that at any point p, I can always introduce a coordinate system so that at this point, and it's close by neighborhood, I can have the metric treated as a flat metric. And also, the derivatives, the first derivatives of the metric, will vanish. So of course, the Christoffel symbols, they depend on the derivatives of the metric. So that means that the Christoffel symbols will vanish. So this means also that the gammas are equal to 0. And that's the mathematical formulation of the equivalence principle. So now this is a super important statement. So I will not attempt to prove it, but I will at least give you a counting argument why this can be done so. Okay? So a proof of this, but not really. What it will rather be is a counting argument. Argument that this is possible. Okay, so how that goes is that, okay, so I assign to my point P some new coordinate system so that actually this point P is located at x equal to 0 and x prime equal to 0. So now I'm trying to construct new coordinate frame x prime so that in that new x prime this will be true. Okay, so you want to do a coordinate transformation x to x prime, so that in my x prime, you know, this is true at point P. And so in the first step, so step one, I want to make at point P g mu nu equal to eta mu nu. That's what I want to do. And to that, so I'm choosing that x and x prime both coincide and are 0 at p. So then in the vicinity of p, I'll be writing x prime alpha is equal to some coefficient a alpha beta x beta plus some correction, which is of the higher order in x. So if x is 0, I'm exactly at p. I'm here now at the linear distance from p, but not to the higher order distance. Okay. Of course, you can reverse this and write b or a tilde. So x alpha is a tilde alpha beta x prime beta plus o x prime square. So you can write this. Okay. So I'm going to the distance which is linear away from that point. And then I can look at how the metric transforms. And so you know that the new metric in my new coordinates, alpha g prime alpha beta at the point P, is just given by a coordinate transformation of the old metric. Okay, so this is dx gamma dx prime alpha dx delta B x prime beta G gamma delta. And of course, to our order, it's just given by A tilde, gamma alpha, A tilde, delta beta, G, gamma, and delta. Okay. Very good. So this is the metric I started with. It was an ugly metric, G mu nu, in some coordinate system. So now I go to a new coordinate system x prime. This is my new metric, how it looks like there. So now I require that this is actually equal to eta alpha beta. So now this is the requirement that my new metric actually is just a flat metric in my new coordinate system. Okay, so now you look at this and you just do the counting. Is it possible or not? Okay, of course, this is quite a nasty equation because it's quadratic in A's. But anyway, so let's just do the counting argument. But the question is, how many A's do I have at my disposal? How many components A alpha beta has? So it has an index up, index down. Each of them takes four values. So I have how many? 16. So I have 16 A tilde alpha beta at my disposal. So now, how many equations do I require to be satisfied? I require that this ugly beast here, whatever this is, but it's fixed, is equal to eta alpha beta. How many equations are there? Almost 16, but this guy is symmetric, and that guy is symmetric. So it's only 10 equations. So 16 A alpha beta is my response for 10 equations. So I only impose 10 equations, but I have 16 things which I can clearly specify so that this is true. Can I solve this? No? In principle, I should be able to, right? You have 16 things. I can choose whatever they need to be so that my 10 equations are true. Okay? So in principle, can solve. So in other words, you can find these A's so that this is true. Okay? So by the way, I still have 6. So in principle, it should be enough to have 10 of these in order to solve 10 equations. So I still have 6 at my disposal. Do you know what they are? Why do I have 6 extra? Aha, exactly. So note that I have, so precisely, so 6 extra, they precisely correspond to my freedom in the Lorentz transformations. So Lorentz transformation freedom. So in other words, you know, if I find, you know, so that my metric, it really looks like Minkowski metric, I still have 3 rotations and 3 boosts, which I can perform so that the metric will still look like Minkowski metric, right? So that's my freedom. I still have 6 extra things. Oh, very good. So, you know, it's just a counting argument, but, you know, it should work. If the counting works, it typically works. So in other words, by going to a linear order expansion in X, I can actually arrange that my metric at that point looks like eta alpha beta. Okay? So now let's go to a point quadratic away from the point P. So now we want to show that the derivatives can be equal to 0. So step two. Now we do a coordinate transformation. So we have x prime alpha, is whatever was there, A alpha beta x beta. So these are already fixed by requiring that g mu equals to eta mu. But now we go to a quadratic distance. So now we will have b alpha gamma delta x gamma x delta plus o x cube. Okay, so now we go to the next order. Okay, and then we ask, so can we set g mu nu rho equals to zero? Okay, so can we? So how many equations are g mu nu rho equal to zero? Sorry? So 40, yeah? So there's 10 of those and then times 4, so there's 40 equations. 40 equations I demand. How many things do I have here at my disposal to actually, you know, do something? So there's 4, 4, 4, but it's not true, because if you look at this, there's x gamma, x delta. So this guy is symmetric in gamma and delta. So does has to be this one here. Okay, so this is symmetric, so it's 10 times 4. So I have b alpha gamma delta, which has to be symmetric in gamma and delta, otherwise it doesn't make any sense. And then I have 10 times 4, which is precisely 40 components in my b's, 40 things to tune. And so if I'm lucky, I can solve these 40 equations by specifying what these b's are, and it should work. So it's precisely how you do it, and so it should work. And indeed it does. So happy times. Okay, so we can set also the derivatives of the metric equal to zero at the point. Okay, very good. So now you may be thinking, can I keep going, right? So can I go a step three? Can I actually vanish two derivatives of the metric? Okay, so what about, so now step three, what about the second derivatives of the metric? Sigma. Can I make this to be true? Okay. So then, of course, I have to expand to the third order. So then my x prime alpha is a alpha beta, which are fixed. So this is fixed by requiring that my metric looks like eta mu nu. Then b alpha gamma delta x gamma x delta, this is already fixed by requiring that my first derivatives of the metric vanish. And then I go to the third order. So plus c alpha gamma delta iota x gamma x delta x iota plus o x 4. Okay, so can I find now these guys? Okay. So that is true. So how many equations do I have? So I require this to be zero. So how many equations are there?
100.
800, uh-huh. So I have 100 equations now.
100?
So we have. Sorry, what did you say?
I heard you 800.
Okay. Sorry. So we have 100 equations to solve g mu nu rho lambda equals to zero. So now how many objects do we have at our disposal? So we have gamma delta iota, but they all have to be symmetric in there. So this thing is actually symmetric. Okay. So then you are asking, you know, what an object has, well, this index is 3, so it's 4 times, you know, how many 3 out of 4 symmetrized indices we can have. Okay, so now to calculate this, I urge you to look at Wikipedia, and there is a nice technique how to calculate, you know, how many objects this, if you choose index from 4, and then you are choosing 3 symmetric indices, this is given by a Young tableau. And the formula is you take 4 times 5 times 6, divide this by 1 times 2 times 3. Okay, so that's a Young tableau formula, a prescription how you calculate this thing, which should give you at least, I think, 20. So this is the 20 components if you are requiring this thing here. So then we have index alpha as well. So it's 4 times 20 components. Okay, so we have 4 times 20 is the components of C alpha gamma delta iota symmetrized. Okay, just, you know, search Wikipedia, you will find how to calculate these Young tableaus and why this is a Young tableau. So anyway, so we have actually only 80 components to tune. So this is 80, but we have 100 equations to solve. So now we are in trouble. So actually, you know, we have 20 less components. And so that's why we cannot solve, set the second derivative of the metric equal to 0. Okay, so we actually can, but we'll still have at least 20 remaining. So at least 20 of the components of G mu nu lambda rho will not be equal to 0. Okay, so now you may be wondering, you know, whether I can collect these 20 components which are non-trivial out of the second derivative of the metric into some nice object. And the answer is yes. This object is precisely the Riemann tensor. Okay, so this will be hiding in Riemann tensor. And so Riemann tensor, surprise, surprise, so it has to hide only 20 components. It has to have only 20 components in it. But it will be written as an object with 4 indices, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. So this is the Riemann tensor. It is an object with 4 components. Okay. So it's a rank 4 tensor. So in principle, it should have 4 to the 4 components, but it doesn't. It has only 20 components, which precisely hide the information about my non-trivial parts of the second derivatives of the metric. And so in order this to be true, this Riemann tensor will have to have some amazing symmetries so that only it has 20 non-trivial components. Okay, so there will be lots of symmetry here. Lots of symmetries. And you may already start constructing an object out of 4 indices, which has, due to its symmetries, only 20 components. If you succeed, you are basically like Einstein. He succeeded in finding. Okay, so we will continue here tomorrow. But you see, the Riemann tensor structure naturally, you know, emerges just by counting how many derivatives I can set equal to 0 or not. And then, you know, this will be the future of tomorrow's lecture. Okay, questions? All right.